I words real good, guys.
I words good, too.
Yeah.
I am not great. The rhetoric guy,
but he's an amazing singer.
Words?
Ish. Words. Words is an amazing singer?
Words, words, words.
Wasn't that the Weird Al cover?
What's that?
Wasn't that the Weird Al cover? Weird words, word, words?
I don't know.
What would it have been a cover of?
Shakespeare, obviously.
I don't remember. It was good, though. I enjoyed it.
Welcome to the podcast where your hosts sample a different scotch each season while we dive into current social, political, and economic issues each episode. This is Scotch and Socialism.
Welcome to Scotch and Socialism, listeners. This is our second episode. I am one of your co-hosts, Jacob, your resident programmer for the evening.
And I'm Griff, your resident new Instagrammer for the evening.
As it were, new grammar.
New.
That's terrible.
I'm not even going to dignify that, Jake.
I want to press the sound button. And I'm Russ, your resident malevolent benefactor. Just because it annoys
Malevolent
Griff.
Is not a word.
Malevolent.
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 Manana. We have to cut this too.
Manana.
Nope. We're going forward.
It's fine.
We're going to lose listeners.
No, we're not. They don't care.
Probably not. Not
I
this.
Mean, I guess we are actually posted now, but I was going to, like, we don't have a place for our listeners to congregate.
Yeah, somebody posted our initial podcast
I
well
didn't realize
before.
We weren't planning.
What's the
on
problem with it? We sent it out to a focus group.
Yeah.
They liked it.
Is that what we're calling it? iTunes is a focus group.
Yes.
It's iTunes people we know. Well, people of friends of the show.
I mean, nobody's found us on iTunes yet, as far as I've noticed, which I need to go and look
if
up.
If you found us
but
on
hey,
iTunes, leave a comment below.
Somewhere.
On iTunes.
On,
I don't
think you
know
can
if iTunes
comment
works
on
like
iTunes,
that.
But
so
if you go to our website.
ScotchandSocialism.com, there's comments.
There's
keep
comments.
It clean.
And the best way that you can help get this wonderful podcast out is to like, subscribe, and share with friends or
smash that
whatever
like
button that your podcast service uses to follow. Because as more and more people subscribe, it adjusts the
we don't need election algorithms.
Okay, fine. We'll skip past the algorithms. It's the algorithms.
Algorithms
now. Waving my hand. Yeah, that would also be another delightful spinoff podcast. Anyways,
if you want great podcast title ideas, just hit us up.
Yeah.
It's a very niche market.
Oh my gosh.
99 cents per title. We
and,
love it.
Per
and
instance.
Like a tenth of your profit.
Ooh.
That's
gutsy.
That's deep.
That's
go,
gutsy.
Go big or go home.
We might get told to go home.
Talk about malevolent benefactors.
Oh, gosh.
So what are we talking about tonight?
So on this episode, we're going to talk about, I honestly struggled to think up a kind of soundbite friendly title for this. There's been a lot of talk, kind of in popular news, I guess you can say, of skills gap. You know, the skilled labor, basically what colleges are putting out compared to what the market demands. And some of you might be familiar with TV personality Mike Rowe. He did Dirty Jobs on, I think it was Discovery Channel for a long time. Mm-hmm. Really big advocate for skilled trades, skilled labor, you know, kids learning trades, things like that. He even has a foundation that basically pays for applicants' entry fees. He's donated over $1 million.
Dang.
Yeah. Very, very generous. But it's all, you know, it's all for vo-tech trade schools, you know, skilled occupations, things like that. One of the points he raises is that, and we, you know, we'll go into multiples of these points, is that a lot of the kind of old traditional, may not be the right word, but some of the more kind of classic routes through higher education, you know, bachelor's, things like that, are really just landing kids with a lot of debt and not a lot of marketable, transferable skills. We're probably going to use kids and students interchangeably here. We're really talking about kind of that, you know, 18 to 22-ish range.
If we're calling that range kids, does that mean we're old?
Yep.
Yes.
Damn it.
Yeah, we crossed that line probably a few
times. Oh, we sprinted across that line. You're not even 30 yet.
No.
Oh, baby Jake.
Baby. I was going to say, it's terrible.
It's coming for me like a freight train.
Time's a flat circle. Anyway, his message really is kind of, I guess, highlighting students and young people in that 18 to 22 year old range, you know, students who are just coming out of high school or just ending their time in high school or maybe just ending their time in college. And, you know, what's interesting is the three of us have very different educational backgrounds, even though Jake, you and Russ have somewhat similar professional occupations now. So I think we kind of bring a little bit of nuance to this. So I don't know, like, I don't want to go, oh, let's go around the table and do the icebreaker, but let's go around the table. And well, it's interesting, you know, because we have a wide variety of educational and professional backgrounds here in one form or another. I mean, yeah, we bring a decent amount.
I'd say so.
We're all fairly upper middle class white guys, so.
Yeah, you know, and doing the natural thing that you do in a pandemic, which is to start a podcast.
We're so basic.
We are just the worst.
I can't even? Wait, is that a thing?
It was.
You're too old for that.
Yeah. Oh. I'm still learning the leet speak of the generation. Is it all lit, fam?
I don't think it's been lit, fam, for a long time. Corona killed that.
Oh. Yeah, a little bit.
Is it no longer
but
on
I'm wondering,
fleek?
Like, any of the newer generation has no idea what leet speak is.
That's true. I guess we had our own.
Like, that's.
It wasn't necessarily spoken word, but it was definitely. Yeah,
it's very 90s. Generation has 90s their, kid. Although, yeah, slight diatribe, leet passwords, where you, like, swap in letters or numbers for letters and stuff. Horrible idea. Whoops. Super insecure.
Yeah. I should change all my passwords now.
Change your passwords. Get a password manager.
Two-factor authentication and get yourself a VPN.
Yep.
No one's paying us to say this, by the way.
Nope.
We just highly
but
recommend
LastPass or KeepPass or whoever, if you would like to sponsor
we're
us.
Going to have to cut this.
No, we won't. It's fine. So talking about our educational backgrounds, I guess I can go first because I'm probably like the poster child of kind of what Mike Rowe is speaking out against a little bit.
I would see this. It's complicated, but go ahead.
It is complicated, but so did... You know, normal education experience growing up, got all the way through high school. I actually started in college a little, or university, I should say, because I guess they're actually
That's
different.
The difference.
But I started in university a little bit early. I did, in Washington State, we have this program called Running Start, where you can take college courses. At the time that I did it, it was pretty much in the college.
It is.
But it's a little bit more than that now. And so I started my four-year degree while I was in high school, completed a four-year degree and went into the field. I am a software engineer by trade. I did computer science as a degree, and don't let any computer scientists know that I equivocated myself with them because they will come and beat me with sticks.
So quick question before we continue. So you said university versus college. What's the difference?
Usually, well, I don't want to say legally, it's not really a legal thing, but universities can bestow bachelor's, master's, or doctorates, whereas colleges are typically bachelors and usually associates.
Okay.
So gotcha. Like a city college.
So kind of a 2-year versus a 4-year school kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's for the most part.
That's effectively it. Yeah.
Well, I only ask because I have a lot of friends who are obviously UK based and they go to university regardless.
Right.
It is their post-secondary basically.
Well, do they have a 2-year?
I have no idea.
It's interesting.
If you know anything about the United Kingdom's post-secondary educational system, leave a comment below.
We need to make that a soundbite just for you. Like, is that something we have
to do? I think so, yeah.
I think it should be.
Anyways, please continue.
So that's, I guess I'm not exactly what Mike Rowe and that sort of section of society is speaking out against, but I did, and we can talk about this later, I did receive a lot of pushback from cohort who were definitely coming from Mike Rowe's perspective of like, why are you going to a 4-year college program? Just learn all this stuff on your own and go into it. Well, we'll get into that later, but there's a reason why I didn't try and do that on my own. So Russ, what's your educational background?
Yeah, so I come from a small farming town in the middle of nowhere, which is why I'm in computers now. I decided that
you grew them out in the field.
I did. We did something.
Server farm.
I mean, that's where it came. No, don't let anyone tell you that. That's not where it came from. No, it was one of those scenarios where I had worked 18 years of my life, effectively working with my parents, working on the farm, day laboring, if you will. It was a 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. kind of thing, and you you didn't get a lot of free time. And it was one of those things where I would go to school, grade school and whatnot. I would come home from work or come home from school and I would go to work effectively. I would go out and help dad with whatever he needed, you know, putting in fence posts, fixing up machinery for the fall, for the spring, clearing roads, making roads, doing, you know, whatever the crop requirements were for that time of year. Did that for way too long. Went in high school, was approached by the career counselor, as people are, and they said, well, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, get me away from farming. I don't care what it is. Just get me away from these people. Hard workers. Like I have to say, I did pick up a very good work ethic as far as my motivations to actually get out and do stuff. Like I don't like to get up early in the morning, but I do put in 18-hour days. So I ended up going to college at a trade school, effectively, a vo-tech school, just because I was looking for the shortest path from where I was after high school to somewhere in my career path. And the cool thing about tech, and this is interesting because Jacob, you're in tech. You're a computer science major. You're a software engineer. That's considered to be, in my opinion, the dark side of tech. Not to be confused with the IT side, which is infrastructure, networking, systems, operating systems, applications, and that kind of stuff. We are so far apart in tech. Everyone's like, well, what's, you know, you guys work in tech. You both know computers, right? It's like, well, technically.
Very different.
Sort of.
Like, yeah. Like I am less likely to be able to actually fix your day-to-day problems.
Absolutely. But you can write an application that I can't.
Right.
Now I have to support that damn application.
And that's why we have DevOps.
Pretty much.
Ish. Sure.
I'm nutshelling here.
But yeah, so I went to school for 2 years at a vo-tech school to get my Associates of Applied Science. And then I stepped into IT and started making six figures within the first 10 years. It was fantastic for me, but I also knew what I wanted, which I think is very rare.
Tremendously.
Very.
Coming out of secondary, and understanding what you want to do in a career path without really experiencing anything.
Extremely rare.
Extremely rare. Extremely hard. I highly recommend people go out and at least shadow jobs, intern, do what you can to figure out what's available, and then pick what you like.
Yep.
You know, don't just go to school. Like, that's for me. I got lucky, but I have so many friends who were in college for 6 years,
yeah.
7 years. They were doing gen ed for like the first 2 or 3 years because they didn't know what they wanted to do. Then they dabbled. They went to this and they tried it for a bit. They came back. They tried something else. They didn't like it. And they still, even to this day, aren't doing anything, in my opinion, that really is what they want to do. They're just doing something because now they have a family. They have to work. They had to get a degree.
Mm.
And now they feel a little trapped, unfortunately.
See, this is a really, I'm going to try not to talk too much during this topic because I've got a lot of kind of connection to it. Coming out of high school, I was just bound and determined to be a Lamborghini mechanic. I did 2 years at a local trade school in Spokane. Automotive program, worked as a line tech for a Chevy Cadillac dealer. I have an Associates of Applied Sciences in Automotive Technology. I had 4 ASC certifications when I graduated. And yeah, I was on track to do the mechanic thing forever. Come from a fairly long line of mechanics, and I'm still a car guy through and through. But I got actually in the field working as a mechanic and just didn't like it. I mean, we can go into this later. Mostly came down to the culture there. It was about money and about just pragmatism, which is fine. But if you have a passion for cars, it may not be the occupation you want to pursue because it can ruin your passion. Mm. If you make your passion your day-to-day sometimes. But it's getting a little bit down the rabbit trail. After I did the associates for automotive, I went to the other community college here in town, got my general ed classes done because I decided to go to the same college that Jake did, but I was going to pursue technical communication, basically tech writing, a little bit of design in there as well, because I bought into the idea that tech writers can make six figures. Technically, they can.
I'm sure some of them do.
Some of them do if they specialize. Decided partway through that I didn't want to do that either and thought, you know, I think I'd like to teach college. So I knew for that, at minimum, I'd have to get a master's degree. So I went to Auburn University, got a master's in English rhetoric and composition, had teaching experience there, came out of that. And about halfway through my master's program, I actually came to the hard realization that if you didn't have a PhD, you were not going to get a full-time job teaching at the college level anywhere you'd want to. I didn't feel like doing another 5 years of deep, intensive rhetorical study, making, you know, 15 grand a year. So I said, I'm done with the student life. I sold cars for 9 months in the Seattle area, which was amazing learning experience. Then wound up at my old alma mater as a Running Start advisor, which is the same program Jake went through when he was doing his degree. Worked with about 1,500 kids for the years I was there and heard a lot of their stories of, well, I got to go to college to be a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer. I'm like, we can get into this later, but just a lot of that mentality pervaded, I would say, probably a good third of the students that I worked with. Yep. These were smart kids. These were very well-educated, very bright kids.
Pretty similar to mine. Like I'm blessed, and we can also talk about this later, to have really enjoyed working in a field that pays pretty well. Like I'm right. making six figures now, partly due to the fact that I'm working for a company in San Jose, or that's based in San Jose. And, but you know, growing up, my dad, especially man full of quirks, was like, nope, you need to be an orthodontist. For those of you who are not in the room, I just got some very strange looks. Yeah, Cole, because they make tons of money and you don't have to work all that much. Well, I mean, it takes forever to get to that point.
Absolutely. Dental school is no joke.
No, it's not.
And that's interesting, too, because, you know, like my parents both have never been to a college. Like my dad, at least not to my knowledge. If they're listening to this, I'm sorry.
That'd be amazing if your parents are listening to this podcast.
Dude, I'm
shout out to Russ's parents, by the way.
Yeah, I'm down. But both, as far as I'm aware, neither of my parents went to college, and they were actually very excited when I was growing up to be like, hey, you need to go to college. They were very much pushing it on me. Now, college to them was anything after, you know, secondary education. So trade school, four-year college, bachelor's, master's, whatever, just go do something. So I was actually very motivated when I got out, not only because they wanted me out of the house, but they were willing to help. And unfortunately, you know, being a farmer, I guess I shouldn't say unfortunately, fortunately/unfortunately, not a lot of money, a lot of revenue. Not a lot of profit, but agriculture industry, great grants, some amazing grants that I was able to, I had access to because I came from a agriculture background, which didn't apply to an IT major.
That's interesting.
I was turned down for a couple of grants because of the major that I was going into was Tech Votech.
They're pretty, something like that. Yeah. But they're pretty harsh on the whole, like, no, if you want these grants, you need to apply it to some sort of ag.
Well, and the sad thing was, like, it wasn't even just ag, though. It was, I could have done computer science at U of I. They were okay with that, but I couldn't do hands-on training in a Votech school.
Oh, I see.
And that was the thing. That was the cutoff. Yeah. It's like, well, and I shouldn't say it was just tech, right? It was also the mechanics, the diesel mechanics side. It was anything that was truly a Votech course was exempt from this scholarship that I was looking
really?
For. Really? Yeah.
Interesting, which isn't not what I would have expected.
Mind you, this was circa 2000. Yay, I graduated in 2000. So it's been a while, you know, 21 years or so.
Sure, but it's like because ag is very much a vocational, by and large,
well, you would think,
sort of
right?
thing. And so, like, you would think that they would be also pushing for this. But, I mean, I guess that's kind of pushing us into our point. So one of Mike Rowe's big, I guess the big thesis behind his argument is that high schools and a lot of education, not just secondary education, push like you need to go to college, mm-hmm. and that's just it. Like, and a lot of I feel our societal worth is built up in like, if I don't go to college, then I am dumb, then I am not worth much, lazy, et cetera, et cetera.
That's a negative thing.
I was gonna say, there's absolutely a stigma. Like, if you look at some people, it's like, well, I want to go to a 4-year degree, or I want to get a 4-year degree because it makes
kind of put them up on a pedestal.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It also doesn't help that, you know, and speaking from personal experience, IT doesn't really care about degrees. Like every place that I've ever worked, they look at experience or a degree. If you're looking to get into the initial, you know, your initial career path, get a certificate, get a degree, go do that to get the foot in the door.
For sure.
Once you start working in tech, however, they don't care. Nobody cares. I just picked up a job that requires a bachelor's or 8 years of experience and 15 years plus experience. They said, oh, you? Yeah, come here. You know,
it speaks for itself.
Oh, absolutely.
It does. And it's funny because like I'm in my current job a little bit in the opposite because we are very research based. Like our products are for the research market, research and analysis. And so like they are very into like, so what school did you go to?
Oh, absolutely.
Now I'm lucky. Like I'm a software engineer. Like I just have my bachelor's, but a lot of my colleagues, that are hired there, it's like, but where did you do your postdoctorate?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, it's huge. But this is kind of like what Mike Rowe is talking about. Sorry for the diatribe, guys. Is that this stigma that's being put on folks who don't want to go to college, or should I say this false pedestal that four-year degrees or whatever is being put on is causing jobs to go unfulfilled.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, like, because his big show, Dirty Jobs, you know, that's what a lot of us think of when we think of low tech, which it's very, not always that.
It's very blue collar, right? I mean,
yeah, blue collar, but a lot of like, you know, what do we mean when we're talking about vocational stuff? Plumbers,
electricians,
carpenters,
mechanics,
well, hands-on trade.
I mean, a lot of stuff that like our grandparents and parents really did. Like that was a huge portion of the labor force.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Back in their generation.
But see, this is what's interesting is that, I mean, we just heard Russ talk about his parents very much being advocates for him to go to college. I know they weren't consciously perpetuating a stigma, but when you have very key adult figures in your young life telling you, oh, you should do this, you should do this. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're young. You don't really, you know, maybe you don't have a great idea. You listen to them, you know? And so the stigma kind of ends up getting perpetuated that way. My parents are, my dad's first generation college. My mom is not. My mom's mother went to college and actually had a degree in marketing and then was like a social worker for a number of years. I don't remember if my maternal grandfather went to college. I don't think he did. He was in the Navy. But they, you know, he was in logistics and, you know, trucking and things like that. And my paternal grandfather had worked at the same automotive shop, the one that's been in our family. He's worked there since he was 19 and he's 87 years old now. But it was still very much this idea of, you know, the parents work the quote unquote dirty job so that the kid can go to the college and get the, you know, you go to the nice shiny college and get right. the degree and get the office job. And during
that theoretically pays way better. You'll right. be way better off.
Well, during their time, you got to think my grandparents were born in the early mid 30s when they were a very formative years. It was the 50s. Mm-hmm. And so 50s, late 60s, when a bachelor's in something could get you set for life.
Yeah.
Basically like, oh, I've got a bachelor's in communication and business. It's like, how many thousands of dollars do you want to make a month? You know, mm-hmm. these days you get a bachelor's in communications and business, you're going to get laughed out of a lot of interviews.
Yeah.
You even get the interviews.
And that's definitely what Mike Rowe's point really kind of revolves around is like, I have two points here about like basically college or universities, especially, but colleges or post-secondary education right. incurs a lot of debt.
Yeah,
absolutely.
For the most part, like Griff
and
I,
that's a tricky thing. We should talk about debt.
And we totally should. Yeah, we will. But Griff and I went to a university that is relatively low cost. Comparison to a lot of like the horror stories that you hear from the sure. side that's advocating for less college. Like I paid on that's average, true. I think $10,000 a year, which is
about right.
very low in comparison to,
but
like the average argument that you hear is like, you're paying $100,000 a year for a liberal arts degree or whatever.
See, but here's the thing. And I want to come back to this later. We don't have to get into it right now. The conversation around collegiate debt gets turned into a hammer because it makes for good sound bites.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, little Jimmy's, you know, $190,000 in debt for a psychology degree. It's like,
which psychologists, if you
well, psychiatrists get can make a ton of money. It's different.
Which one's,
big difference.
I forget which
one's
which.
Psychiatrists, you have to go to medical school.
Yes.
And you are a doctor of yeah. psychiatry.
And you
psychiatry.
Can make bank.
Make $200,000. That's not, the point being is that a lot of times in, you know, popular media, much as I hate to say that, you'll see these horror stories of kids in six figures worth of debt. And now they, you know, they're baristas or they're working menial jobs and they're drowning. And these are the stories that get, you know, rolled out when we try to make a point about, oh, trade school, skilled trade. I want to make it clear. Those are the outlier. Okay. We've done a lot, not a lot. We've done a decent amount of research.
More than last time.
More than last time. Well, it's something that was really fascinating to me. And I used it in my old job because I was an advisor for students in the Running Start program, high schoolers who were getting their bachelor's degrees. And I looked up a lot of the statistics around the debt load that a lot of students are coming out of schools with. And the majority of students are not coming out of four-year degrees, you know, hopelessly lost in debt. They are in debt, most of them, but it's not always insurmountable. Students who come, and the funny thing is that I found that students who are coming out of four-year private schools usually have the least amount of debt.
Interesting.
And they have the best return on that debt. Mm-hmm. So they almost leverage it.
Mm-hmm.
Students who come out of public 4 years, a little bit more, not, you know, leaps and bounds more. We're talking like 20,000 versus 22, 23, 24,000 on average. And their default rates are very low. And the more you borrow, the more likely you are to repay it, which kind of makes sense. Because if you borrow $180,000 to go to law school or $200,000 to go to med school, you can make a ton of money as a lawyer or a doctor. And I have a friend who went to UC Berkeley for his JD, had to take out some debt, but he paid it back within like 3 years working at a firm in Los Angeles.
Right.
And he lived very frugally for 3 years, but he paid it back and he's debt-free, and now he clerks for a judge. The people who get hit the hardest, and this should not be a surprise to anyone, when it comes to default rates and if you think about it in terms of debt to income, are people who went to private, for-profit, quote-unquote, almost tech schools, like Paul Mitchell Hare Academy is one of the worst. ITT Tech is one of the worst when it comes to default rates. Those students default at like 43%.
Jeez.
And these are not big sums of money comparatively. They're like $10,000, $12,000.
Yeah.
But because they're private, for-profit schools, the federal government does not back those loans. Mm. So you're not really eligible for loan forgiveness. You're not eligible for any type of, you know, help. And the interest rates can be absurd, and the interest just piles up and piles up and piles up. So they go to these schools. They don't get a great augmentation to their skills. They've paid a ton of money for it, and now they're up to their ears in debt that will not go down because they don't make enough to keep up with the payments.
Right.
And surprise, surprise, most of them are minority or economically disadvantaged. That's my sidebar.
I'd say that it's not even necessarily a sidebar, though. That's a huge counterpoint to the whole, like, you know, higher education is bad, quote unquote, which is not what Mike Rowe is saying.
No.
And I want to make that clear. Like, that is not what I think that Mike Rowe is saying, but that's often what we'll hear in surrounding circles coming out of there is like, why are you going to hire like to a university? It's just a waste of money. Just go do a trade school instead. Well, that's not always what is available for if you know what vocation you want to go into. Mm-hmm. That's not always a thing. Like for me, even though I work in tech with Russ, we work in very different sides of tech. I work in the quote unquote theoretical space, although calling it theoretical seems odd to me anyways, but there is almost no way that I could have broken into the field without having a four-year degree behind me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
And that's the thing is getting in the door is always going to be the hardest part, right? And that's why I feel like once you get out of school, you know, there might be some of these examples where they've gone to very prestigious four-year colleges. They have a lot of debt. And the question is, what's the timeline for getting their first job?
Yeah.
Right. Because they're working as baristas because they need some income. We all do, right? We all have to have some base level of income. I don't care if you're living with your parents or, you know, you found this nice, cheap apartment that opens into an alley. You need to pay for this stuff. And unfortunately, I think that time to find the job is really what people emphasize. It's like, well, oh, you got out of school 6 months ago and, you know, you're $200,000 in debt. And, you know, how are you making these payments? Like, how are you living? It's like, well, I'm looking for a job. That's what I'm doing.
Right.
I got extremely lucky. I did my first interview last year.
Perez is an outlier.
I've been in the industry for 20 plus years.
Yeah.
And I did my first real interview for a company last year. Up to that point, it was right place, right time. Yeah. And, oh, hey, did you need a job? I'd love one. Okay. Why don't you come up on Monday?
Well, okay. The thing is, you've got the skill set and you've got the connections.
Well, and that was part of it, right?
Getting your network.
The skill set was absolutely a thing. Networking is huge. I don't mean that in the IT sense. I mean that in the socialization sense.
Well, also in the IT sense, but yes.
Well, in my world, right? But yeah, no, who you know makes a huge difference.
Absolutely.
And going to a school in a small community like I did, everyone knew everyone else. We had a class of 18 people. Everyone in the community knew when we were graduating. They came and found us. Mm-hmm. They seeked us out.
See, and that is one of the. Oh, that's right.
Okay.
That is one of the the good. Sought.
That's the word I was looking for.
They went to you.
Come on, rhetoric boy.
It's after five. I don't have to rhetoric anymore. That is one of the things that is really invaluable about college is that you have the opportunity to meet a lot of people and get involved with a lot of extracurricular activities you may not have had otherwise. Now, that's not to say that, you should, push off or issue going to trade school to go network at college. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is your college experience can really be, if you go to a four-year, can really be what you make it.
Oh, yes.
I did not make the most of my bachelor's program, which is probably why the feelings I have around it. I did when I was getting my bachelor's work as a student worker in a department that I later came back and worked full time for. So that was the networking. That was kind of the example of the connection being made, turning into a job. My graduate program, I spent way more time doing extracurriculars and meeting people and getting involved with clubs and all of this stuff. So college is really going to be what you make it.
Yeah.
And, you can be getting a bachelor's in philosophy, which is kind of a punching bag. But if you, it is, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But if you take the time to, meet the right people, get involved, put yourself out there and do something beyond just the classwork, you're going to get a way better return on your investment. That's really what it is. Than if you just go through the motions of, doing the coursework and calling it good. That's not going to,
And I think of course, that's something that you should be applying to all of life. Like my job, if I were to do the same sort of thing, I could probably figure out how to float by in my job without putting a ton of effort in. I've had colleagues who did that and they lasted at this particular job, the one that I'm in right now, for decades, causing me no end to consternation, but you can absolutely apply that. And the earlier on that you gain that sort of motivation, the better off you're going to be, whether you're going through 4-year, whether you're getting a doctorate or going through VOTEC or going straight into the workforce. It's like with what you have to do with finances. The earlier that you invest, the
time
more
is
that you're going to get. Yeah. And so I kind of wanted to touch on this idea of finding your vocation, I guess, because that's a really tricky.
I want to complicate that a little bit, if I could.
Of course you do.
Go for it.
We need the grad school buzzword bell. Ding, 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 ding.
I'll buy a cowbell and a drumstick.
I'm sure we have a cowbell program or whatever on this.
It's not as much fun if I can.
That's true. We need the actual physical cowbell.
It's called Foley in the biz.
What's interesting is that not all of our professions, but you can see the lines of VOTEC versus non-VOTEC versus trade, whatever, really start to blur. Because if you take your two occupations, Russ in networking and IT, Jake in development software, you both have professional certificates, professional degrees. You got this degree to get a job, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's what's kind of, getting complex about it is that, if you go to a 4-year university, do a liberal arts program, but you do that so that you can go to law school.
Right.
That's a very professional track, And so I think if, when you hear advocates of VOTEC and advocates of skilled trade, like Roe and all them talking about these things, it feels like they kind of shoehorn, plumbers, electricians, pipe fitters, boilermakers, mechanics. I mean, they would have the same certificates Russ would.
Absolutely.
Coming out of their programs.
Yeah, I think there's more of an apprenticeship
that's true
route as well to several of those. But
why would there be, or should there, could there, should there, could there be an apprentice approach to networking or software development?
I think there is. I mean,
certainly for networking, yeah.
Oh yeah.
For software development, not so much in. I think there could be. Sorry, oh, okay. I'm saying that there's not currently.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
The closest thing that we would have is an internship, and usually, like, I was never a software intern. Griff and I actually met working for the same college, which, gosh, we could tell stories. Probably
that's a whole different
separate podcast.
It's called Vindictive Employees. Look that one up.
But. Like, I have worked with other interns. Like, my current company, we would hire an intern on for our department every summer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And
all the companies I've worked in did the same kind of thing.
Right. But the interns that we got, by and large, I felt kind of bad. We always gave them a lot of busy work.
Oh, absolutely.
That's not all of our interns. There was an intern that I remember that came in, like, 2019, who could code, like, way better than half of us. And not in a necessarily well-engineered way, but he had such a mind for research and figuring out how things work. Like, without getting into too many details, we had a really, really horrible hardware vendor that didn't document anything, and we had to try and figure out what type of commands that we could even send to this device, and they didn't give us any info.
Mm.
And this intern took it and freaking ran with it. This is a project that would take seasoned engineers super difficult times. And so, not to say that all internships are worthless, but a lot of them can be, because I also had another intern who, granted, she wasn't really a software background, and so there wasn't a whole lot that I could give her, but I give her a lot of busy work that was important. I needed her to research performances of databases, sure, and stuff, which is just time-consuming, mind-numbing, god-awful work. But it wasn't like if I were to continue, or if she was to continue to go on into the software engineering field, that wouldn't have been a tremendously useful thing to have in her experience bucket. Because I was effectively, I told her what to write, but or what to do.
Right.
I just needed her to actually do it and pay attention to what was going on. But finding your vocation, I think that's something that Russ touched on very early in this episode. And I think it's something that's incredibly important where, I feel like at least I have a moderately differing view on this, in that, you know, the finding your eventual profession, vocation, or whatever, it's not as simple as a lot of schools make it out to be.
No.
Like secondary education, it's like, oh, just take this aptitude test and you know what you want to do for the rest of your life. That is a lie.
When I took those career aptitude tests, they always said it was almost split 50-50 down the line. Oh, you should be an artist or a designer, or you should be a janitor.
Yeah, like, mine was
okay.
Something to do with computers, which is at least on the point, yeah, for me. But it was either that or social work. Like, I had no in between. It was very odd.
Really?
And it depended on the day that I took it.
Well, if you look at, like, the skill set required for both of those, right, software engineering or even social work, I feel like it follows the same set of procedures. And so I could see them kind of going both ways.
Yeah,
I
could.
This is interesting. Go on.
I know, right? So for myself, it was either IT-based related stuff, or it was manufacturing,
right,
logistics-based, which hand in hand, a lot of the same concepts apply, just a little bit, you know, obviously different application. But I could see how some, you know, you're going to have those things that kind of mirror in different, very different types of workspaces.
But to talk about, like, there's so much pressure, at least for me there was, going through high school of like, well, you have to figure out what you're going to major in, because of course the assumption was you're going to college.
Oh,
and I don't agree with that assumption that you should be that everybody should get a 4-year. However, like once you're out of high school and you're trying to figure out, okay, what do I want to do with my life? Because most of us work 40 hours a week, if not more. That's a substantial portion of your life.
Absolutely. And you should pick something that you enjoy.
Right. But
or that you can tolerate.
Tolerate that makes you a good amount of cash or whatever. Like balancing
don't
that
hate
whole
your life because of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Balancing that whole issue of like income versus quality of life, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's the work to live versus live
to work.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And so for me, like Russ, for you kind of brought up this idea of like, don't don't go to college until you know what you want to do. Mm. For me, I kind of had the opposite experience where I went to college assuming I had planned already on going into mechanical engineering. Mm. I took a couple of courses in high school, really enjoyed it. Like I took those courses over again because I really enjoyed
it. I did the same thing.
It was project based. Yeah. But I got to college and that's where I realized, oh, I really, really enjoy programming and software right. engineering. There is value in beginning that educational process, I think, but it of course has to be balanced and it's a risk. Ultimately, so many of these things that we're talking about is a risk. Because a bachelor's, what is the point of a bachelor's degree?
Depends on what the degree's in.
Depends on what the degree's in, but overall, like a bachelor's has so much what we call gen ed, general education requirements.
Right.
What's the reason behind that?
Well, I mean, you've got the classic, I mean, sorry, you're opening a can of worms here.
I know.
With the,
I love
with
it.
The English major. I think a lot of the general education curriculum, and these are classes like your social sciences, lab sciences, arts and humanities, things like that, are rooted in the quote unquote liberal arts tradition. And this goes back a long time in the history of higher education where that's pretty much what you went to school for when they, you know, when college was about training, you know, diplomats or statesmen or lawyers or thinkers. You know, you went to college to be a thinker and you went to trade school to be a worker. Hmm. And that, I mean, that might be where the root of all of this kind of starts to lie is, you know, traditionally the I'm talking a long time ago, like probably 100 and something years or so, is the higher education tradition is rooted in that sense of yep. you came here to do something more than just work with your hands. So we're going to train your mind on how to think and how to be a quote unquote well-rounded person. I know that gets thrown around a lot. When I was a Running Start advisor, I was working with kids who were 16, 17 years old, doing their junior and senior year in high school as freshmen and sophomore in college. And every time I met with my students, I said, what do you want to do? And they're either they were like, I want to do this one particular thing and no doubt about it, or they or would change every time I asked them. And I asked them every time because of that. I had students who started as wanting to go to nursing school. And the last time we met, they said they were dropping the program and going to welding program. And so, you know, there's so many options out there. And that's a bit of a tangent. Sorry, what I was trying to land this plane on is a lot of them who went into or who wanted to go into, honestly, the more STEM-oriented mm-hmm. programs, science, tech, engineering, and math, didn't really see the point of the general ed stuff, like the history and the social studies classes. I mean, I kind of understand that in a practical sense. The social sciences, you know, a high-minded liberal arts thinker in me screamed at them because of that. No, you need to learn about history, you know, because I ate that stuff up.
Sure.
But I think it really highlighted a fact that we kind of have a gulf in our country's educational system between just a 2-year apprenticeship or a certification program and a 4-year bachelor's degree. You know, I think that a lot of the classes that were tied to the bachelor's degrees in your STEM fields are very, very applicable. Not all of them. But then you've got kids who, you know, they want more than just the 2-year vo-tech, but they don't want to go full 4 years doing all of the prereqs and gen eds and things like that, because that usually bogs them down and yep. they end up going 4.5, 5, sometimes 6 years for bachelor's. In college, time equals money. I don't know. Maybe there needs to be some sort of kind of middle ground where you get a little more of the theory, you get a little more of the in-depth look at these professions, but you go beyond, you know, what the vo-tech programs would cover. And that's not to diminish vo-tech programs by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
I just think that there needs to be, because we're at this point where, you know, we've got such a broad spectrum of abilities in these students and interest areas, I give them something a little bit more, you know. And we're really big on online school, like, oh, we're going to meet the student where they are. Even with online school, you're still going through the same gen ed classes. Like most of yep. my former colleges online classes are gen ed classes.
Yes.
You know, you can't take statics online through this college. You can't take, the ironic thing is you can't take any computer programming courses online through this college.
yeah, but, that was more of a problem with the college than it was with the online platform.
Yeah, we can
platform.
Get into that later.
but I think you're really hitting on a point that like I've been chewing on when talking with, you know, because I used to be a youth leader or whatever at a church, and I'd be talking with some of my students also high school age and trying to figure out what the hell they're going to do with the rest of their life. And of course, you know, you have that also youth group thing of like, you should join the church internship program.
Absolutely.
Shameless plug.
If that is the way that you want to go, awesome. But don't think that you're required to do that. Sorry, little bit of a soapbox. I'll probably get on a different soapbox later in this podcast. But we either, like you said, we have this gulf of like either just grade school and not, often society puts the just on there. I think trade schools are a wonderful thing. Let me put that out there first. Or you go into this higher ed, which has all the other gen eds and things like that. And I think personally, one of the biggest ways that we could combat this sort of issue, because we have this kind of gulf of like very narrow minded and focus, but not a whole lot of, you know, cultural understanding or understanding of history of things that went on, was like pull a lot of that stuff that you would take as a bachelor's student in college, get it down into the high schools.
Mm-mm.
Like
high schools can't do it. They're too busy teaching to the tests.
True. I mean, that's the issue, right? Right. It's like we're so test oriented and yet we are abysmal on our test scores compared to the rest of the world, which is a whole other probably topic. But but if we could try and bring some of that into secondary education and put worth behind it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the classic argument that I always got from my students when I was helping them with their math homework was like, ugh, I'm never going to have to use algebra when I'm like out of there, which for a lot of students,
it's true.
Yeah, it's pretty true. For me, not so much. Like I use algebra even when I'm not realizing it because I'm a programmer.
Actually, what was really interesting about that is I didn't start using math as an IT person, mm-hmm. until I got into software development.
Yeah. I mean, it's all based around algebra and mathematics.
And even trig to some extent. I just had to go relearn Euler's angles, mm-hmm. Because I'm doing programming in 3D space.
Right.
And in order to rotate a 3D object, you have to understand four, you know, coordinate system, which my brain.
And
that was the thing. It's like all of my IT career, I mean, the worst that I had to learn was binary and hexadecimal. Like those were not complex.
Yeah.
Understanding the basics of them, sure. I mean, the ability to add and subtract binary, it's probably not going to actually use that.
Yeah.
But it's something I can do. You know, it's a fun parlor trick, right? but I didn't get into any of the heavier math stuff until I started doing software engineering, which was really weird because I would have assumed that working in tech with the stresses that I had in college with you got to do trig, you got to do Calc 1, you know, these are all your gen ed for my degree. You know, I got out and 20 plus years later, oh yeah, I'm working on something that's not even in my field. Yeah. And suddenly I'm starting to use, you know, this kind of stuff.
Well, I think this is an interesting thing. And I wonder what, I'm just going to use micro as kind of the voice of this. I don't want to even say counter narrative. The other part of this conversation, sure. What would be interesting to see him say about this is I wonder how many classes are included in these curriculums for these various degree plans that aren't really necessary for these degree plans.
They just need to fill credits.
What's that?
They just need to fill credits.
Yeah. Why?
Well, it's just when I graduated, I had to have 144 credits.
Why?
Because that was state curriculum funding.
That's an arbitrary number.
Probably. But according to the people that I was working with, the amount of credits was strictly based on if their students got less than 144 credits, they were not eligible for funding from the state.
And see, at the college level, if your college is on quarters, it's 180 for bachelor's.
Oh, well,
which is, see, but this goes back to that, it kind of goes back to the same thing, is you've got these curriculums being developed at the university level that are probably including classes with subject matters that don't really apply. Like, I don't think we've said the college that we were affiliated with.
Nope.
So we won't. No. At this university, Jake and I got our bachelor's. I've seen the curriculums for the computer science programs, and they want students to take pre-calc 1, pre-calc 2, calc 1, calc 2, calc 3, linear algebra.
Calc 3 now?
Yeah, maybe.
I think it was optional. Now, for a lot of those math classes, I can tell you that they are required for the theory behind what I do. I don't use them on a day-to-day basis, but in order to learn, we'll say algorithms class for the example, we talk about some very heady math things called time complexity and how to measure. Basically, it's how to measure how long your program is going to take. And it's not just, you know, number of seconds. It's, it has to do with, like, number of calculations that you do and stuff like that. And there is actually some calculus that's involved with that. Now, I don't think you have to go through Calc 2 to do all of that. I think you can learn a subset of calculus and really
be okay. An applied calculus course? And granted, we're looking at one very small regional comprehensive university. So this is by no means the standard. I don't know what some of the bigger schools do. But I wonder how much of a disconnect there is between the industry and the curriculums being developed at these colleges that are ending up putting kids through classes that, you know, cost them money, cost them time, especially if they don't pass them. Because the fail rate for math at this university is very high.
There is a reason for that, because our math department wasn't
struggles. And so that just, anytime you talk about classes that aren't necessary, you're piling on money and time that these kids aren't going to get back. Yeah. And so I almost wonder if there's a misalignment between industry and college. And I wonder, I would say that's probably why you see more and more of these boot camps coming up.
Coding world?
Yeah, absolutely. And more and more of these, you know, like Google has their IT support program, mm-hmm. or Amazon has this thing, or Microsoft. The big companies have curriculums that are usually cheap or free that students can do at their own pace, kind of locks you in a little bit. And I'm wondering if we're kind of trending that direction, where boot camps and employer-specific training programs are going to start to take the place of some of the more traditional post-secondary vocational tracks.
Yeah, and I would not be surprised if that's the case. Like, the coding boot camps are not one-to-one, but they are becoming the trade school equivalent for software engineers. Now, to anybody out there who's considering a coding academy or whatever, I would say be very careful with that, because there are a lot of companies, especially larger companies, that won't want to hire you, because they're also very locked into this idea of, like, no, you need a four-year degree and you need 5 years of experience in a field that's only 2 years old, sort of a thing. That's a whole other podcast. And so be very careful with that. But I think we're going to start seeing that more and more, certainly in the software space. And I would almost kind of hope in other spaces. I don't know. This comes back to, like, I love trade schools. Like, having not been through one, having having had students who went through them. And we have a school here in the city where we're at that is...
I already said Spokane.
You did say Spokane, sorry. We're not sure.
You went to school in Spokane, is all we heard.
Yeah, that's we're true. Not sure how secretive we're going to be about our identities on this podcast. But we have Spokane Valley Tech School, I think, which is a high school. It's not post-secondary. Really? Yeah.
SVT. I worked with...
SVT,
I worked with them.
And I had some youth students that went through there, and I think it's wonderful. Because it's much more geared towards that. Now, I think we do absolutely, like, the reason why I like bachelor's programs is because it does also force people into a more rounded space. Like, you have to take courses in stuff that you probably wouldn't have touched otherwise. Right. I think there might be a different and better way to approach that. Like, my preferred approach would be to push that more towards secondary schools, but that requires a huge change in our education system.
We're talking about a gigantic paradigm shift at that point.
Yep.
And especially because a lot of secondary, just public K-12 in general, is so rooted in policy and bureaucracy, which is in and of itself a bad thing. I love public schools, period. But I think that they are inefficient at how they go about preparing students. I don't know how much the public education system, the K-12 system, has changed in the last, like, 30 or 40 years, you know?
You'll go hang out with your high schooler friends?
My high schooler friends. I could ask my mom. My mom's a counselor. She's been counseling for 20 something years.
Your mom was my counselor.
That's weird when you say it like that.
It really was.
It really was. I know it has to have changed in some ways, but I also know that change is a four-letter word to public bureaucracies.
You went to public school, didn't you?
Yes, all the way through. They're a double-edged sword. You know, they're very much a double-edged sword. It's just like any kind of public service. There are good things and bad things.
Yep.
But it seems like the philosophy, now this is changing a little bit, I will grant, but it seems like for a long time, the philosophy of high school was to funnel kids into colleges. You know, that's why we taught to standardized tests. That's why we taught to the SATs and all these, you know, acronymic test models, prep kids for getting into college. Never mind the fact we didn't spend a lot of time teaching them about, you know, civic knowledge or financial knowledge, mm-hmm. or, you know, basic how to be a productive citizen knowledge. We didn't spend a lot of time in exploring VoTech. We did have career and tech ed requirements for our graduation, but that, for me, it was auto shop. You know, I didn't know of anything else. We had metals, we had wood, photography, auto, and like maybe we had like entry web design, but this was 05, you know?
Oh yeah. We had quote unquote web design classes, which was, I think you kind of had some HTML, but it was like all Microsoft Word or something weird like that. I've never touched it. French page was dead by then. Thank God. But yeah, it's.
You are young, aren't you?
Public education is, it's a sticky wicket.
I will say that while I was in my former position working with high school students, I did notice a trend in the variety of classes that kids could take to meet their career in tech ed or VoTech classes requirements at the high schools, which is encouraging. And I know that at least this state is angling more towards what's called a T24 post-secondary plans. T being trade, 2 being 2-year college, 4 being 4-year college. So it's not necessarily, on paper at least, the pipeline into the college. Now, they want you to do something after high school, obviously.
Sure.
But it's not such lockstep. Like my mom, the counselor, you know, is very much about, you know, find the path that fits you and what mm-hmm. is valuable to you. If that's going to be an electrician, great, do it. If that's going to be a doctor or an accountant, great, do that. And that, I think, does, when you get an institutional change like that, at least on paper, to I think it does start to weaken, not break, but at least weaken a little bit the stigma. You still have the societal element, though.
Yep.
You know, the parents, the family, things like that.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, I feel like it comes and goes in cycles of generations, I guess, and it's at different ones for different groups. Like, talking with a number of my friends whose parents or grandparents were immigrants, there's a huge emphasis on...
Oh, yeah.
On higher education, specifically like those, you know, those vauded sort of vocations, doctor, engineer, etc. And for our, you know, our sort of, we like my family's been in America for 4 generations on the average. Like we're starting to swing kind of the opposite way again of like, No, go into, like Mike Rose saying, go into these tech vocations or whatever, do the 2-year or an apprenticeship or whatever. Don't waste your money on a bachelor's or...
Well, I think that's what it comes down to, is applicability of how it can build you a lifestyle, because, you know, and this is something that Mike Rose hits on a lot, and a lot of the people who are proponents of non-4-year tracks, is that these jobs are very sustainable, and you're not going to make minimum wage forever. Being a mechanic, being a plumber, you can make decent money doing it.
Yep.
Now, this is not easy work by any means.
And you're going to
age out sooner than you would at like a desk job.
Yep. And you're not going to make those higher paying wages as
for
early.
A while.
Yeah, and as early as a lot of people would like to make you think.
Mm-hmm. That's going very into these. True.
Like that's something that you absolutely have to be careful of, is like, look, and for any job, not just trade schools.
Oh, yeah.
Engineering, for whatever you might be getting a doctorate in, whatever, Look at how much cost you're going to accrue up front, how much cost you're going to do in something like either an apprenticeship or your externship, internship, practicum, whatever. Because a lot of the times you have to pay for
opportunity
that.
Opportunity cost.
Yep. And then like what, you know, first year, what's the average that people make? 5 year, what's the average? 10 and so on.
See, and this brings us kind of a sticky idea is that I think that at some point, maybe this is out there in the general zeitgeist, but we really need to see post-secondary degrees, certificates as commodities. Because we're talking about these in terms of securities, you know, opportunity cost or return on this and this and that. And if you start to think of degrees and post-secondary whatever as commodities and assign value to them in that way, return on investment, you know, it kind of makes sense. Like we've flooded the market with so many bachelor's degrees that they do not have the value that they once did.
Yeah.
Conversely, look at 2-year programs, you know,
We're hurting
millions of unfilled jobs. And so they're paying better.
Yep.
You know, now granted, if you're a first year apprentice electrician, you're going to get the really just garbage calls. You're going to work weekends.
And you're going to be making beans. Nights.
You're not going to make a ton of money. But if you stick with it, you can make a good living.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, that's applicable to anything. Like the opportunity cost for a 2-year program or apprenticeship might be lower up front, but you're going to have a higher, not necessarily always, but you're likely going to have a much higher output of effort required to really get anywhere in that field. Yeah. And a 4-year too, like it's not as easy to break into a good job with a 4-year degree as it was 5, 10, 20 years ago.
And I think that's part of the problem is that, you know, our parents and our parents' parents had that idea of like, oh, a bachelor's is a license to print money.
Pretty much, yeah. That was back in their day. With our day, I mean, we've had such an unemployment spike, especially in the bachelor's degree areas, that it's, if you have an associate, they're not even looked at anymore for entry-level jobs.
Yep.
No.
You know, you want to flip burgers, you better have a bachelor's, which is terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, that's horrible.
Well, and the problem is a lot of schools, I think a lot of universities are catching on to this, and so they're making very specific bachelor's degrees that, I mean, the school that Jake and I went to has a degree catalog of like 135 different bachelor's degrees. And I can tell you that of the sample size I saw of students, 30 degrees got brought up.
Yeah.
Maybe.
On the average.
On average. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, the college that we went, university that we went to, it does have its, you know, it's known for certain programs.
Yeah. As most are.
Yeah. And so that's not too unexpected, but you're right. Like there's a huge explosion of degree programs that, you know,
like the Cheesecake Factory of universities.
A little bit.
We do everything, but none of it very well. Not sponsored.
But we could
by the university or
either.
I don't think our university would want to sponsor us after this episode.
I do want to pose a question to y'all because y'all, both of you have worked in very different locations. I think location is a big part of this. How were vocational trade, whatever we want to call them, jobs perceived in your areas?
So I grew up in Spokane for the most part, aside from living overseas for a little bit, but always back here. And then about 3 years ago, I moved down to San Jose, California, Bay Area, Silicon Valley. I recently moved back up to Spokane.
The dream.
Supposedly. It's not as shiny as the movies make it out to be. Also, the Silicon Valley is usually more San Jose, and San Jose is not San Francisco. San Jose is the capital of software engineering and a lot of engineering practices, too. Like, there was a huge manufacturing kind of boom in the area for computing tech and things like that about 20 years ago, I think. And so there, in that area specifically, there is a huge push by parents for their kids, like you go into engineering and usually it's software engineering. And if you're not going to college for software engineering, you better be getting into something like Stanford or one of the other California state universities. Then you're going to go to these like very lauded coding boot camps, which again, like be careful with that, guys. I'm not saying that they're not good, but you got to be careful with them. But other types of vocations, like when I was a youth leader there as well, though I didn't have very many students, I didn't hear any of them talking about going into anything but tech. Oh. And it's partly due to, like, San Jose. Nobody who lives in San Jose is from San Jose, right? Like, there's such an immigration from all over the states, from all over the world, really, yeah, for people who are working in tech. And so, like, that, you know, there's a lot of, in a lot of families.
So San Jose is the new Detroit.
Yeah, kind
of. Or maybe Austin will be the new Detroit now that California's trimming a bunch of people out.
But it's, but there's this whole sort of thing, like, you know, generational careers. Like, you do what your parents did,
right?
What their parents did, right, and et cetera. And that's like this sort of software engineering thing. Well, it's a new field. Like, in the grand scheme of things, mm-hmm, it's what, 50 years old?
Maybe.
Like, that's what we're seeing here again, at least in San Jose. So, you know, more vocational or less, actually it was just less paying jobs, because in San Jose, what you make is a huge portion of, like, quote unquote, who you are, which, mm-hmm, I take a lot of issue with. But, like, you know, teachers weren't super highly regarded.
Ironic.
I know, which is another bullshit thing. Sorry, Mom. And so, like, they weren't super highly regarded, but even these teachers that are working at, you know, private schools, because, of course, like,
prestigious,
all of these parents who were in engineering fields, they sent their kids off to private schools because public schools are bad, supposedly. They're not.
Prophecy.
Yep. But, like, these teachers were treated kind of like crap, and they're paid like crap, of course, even in the private schools. Like, I knew so many teachers that lived, like, four different teachers to one household. Jeez. And some of them were married, like, four different, quote-unquote, family units, I guess you would say, because they couldn't afford to live there. Like, Silicon Valley is ridiculously expensive to live in. And so engineering, super highly regarded. Everything else, from what I saw, and granted, I have a very small sample size of, you know, what's in the Bay, was definitely rated much, much, much lower.
Right.
So, absolutely. I don't know about you, Russ.
How was it in rural Idaho?
Oh, rural Idaho is fantastic. So I was the black sheep, right? I know. That's,
hey, now.
Sorry.
Alabama? What?
Hey, hey now. That's a little close to home.
That's why I said it.
Oh, gosh.
No, so rural Idaho was interesting because I was the black sheep of the group because I was the one going to tech. Everyone else was doing trade jobs. They were doing plumbers, electricians, farmers, aviation even, which was kind of interesting. But yeah, no, for me, I was the odd man out when I was in high school saying, oh, I want to go do a tech job. And everyone's like, you weirdo. You know, yeah, I was the one who wanted to move out of town and, like, go get a job in the big city because the population of my town that I live in, oh, wait, it's not incorporated. The closest town to where I live was a population of 161 like people.
Jeez. Yeah.
We drove 45 minutes to the big city with a population of 35K.
Jeez.
Boise?
Listen.
Sorry.
Boise has way more.
Boise has a
this was years ago.
True.
Yeah, Boise still, wasn't still always the happening place it is.
But no, at Lewiston, Idaho is where I went to college.
Right.
And it's one of those scenarios where the college only enrolled probably about 1,500 students at the time. My class size was 18. Not a lot. And, you know, to go from my high school, which had a class size of 26, by the way, and no optional classes, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about your wood shop or your metal shop or I don't know, whatever else.
Electives in general.
Electives in general, right? We had Spanish for our mm-hmm, fine arts.
Jeez.
Because we didn't have a choice.
Yep.
We had wood shop, unless the wood shop burned down, which happened a couple of times. But if we didn't have wood shop, we had effectively home ec.
Yeah.
And we built stuff out of balsa wood and home ec. That was the alternative. Not a lot of choice involved there.
Yeah.
And so really you do your basic general education in high school, and then you hope that you go somewhere else. 90% of my class, 10% of it didn't graduate. 90% of whoever's left, I would probably say half of them are still living in the same town. They're still living in that 160 populace.
Mm-hmm.
They took on what their parents were doing, you know?
Right.
One of my friends works as a water sewage treatment plant guy. He took over. He's the head of the division. Fantastic. Great job. He's been doing it now for 20 plus years. But that's what he does. It's what his family has done. Me going off to tech and getting out of the local city, it was weird. And I almost not warranted. Like, it was one of those things where I actively got pushback from some of my peers saying, well, why would you want to do this?
See, that's interesting.
And then I think it is just because of the locale, right? I
mean, sure.
You know, you grew up more in a software engineering type environment.
Ish, but even here, like, yeah. I mean, in the Spokane area, it's relatively rare.
Yeah. But yeah, so it was definitely interesting growing up in an environment where going out and doing something. I mean, if I wanted to go be like a lawyer or a doctor, I think I would have been laughed at. You know, it's just because of the people we were around. It's like, well, you're a farmer. You're not gonna
kind of that audacity sort of thing. Yeah,
it's almost like a putting on airs.
Yeah,
see, that's really interesting because my dad comes from a very very similar background. The town he grew up in is about 100 people. I don't even think it's incorporated. Nearest town, 20 minutes away, maybe 2,000 or 3,000, and then the nearest big city was 40 minutes down the road, mm-hmm. and it's 68, but back then it was probably 40. And yeah, his dad is a mechanic. His mom just worked at the bank as a teller,
yep.
and they like pushed him to leave. He didn't need a lot of help, mm-hmm. but yeah, he went to law school and
awesome.
Went mm-hmm. to the quote unquote big city. So it's interesting that there's that tension between like go, but don't go too far.
Well, and I think it really, the community itself relies on the people to stay there.
Right.
Because if you lose your workers that are coming up from the next generation,
the town's
dead.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going anywhere.
That's true.
And I think that's part of it. Like, that's why there's some pressure to stay. Now, like I said, my parents really wanted me to go to college. They didn't care what for. I mean, I could do underwater basket weaving. They really didn't care. They just wanted me to go do something. And I think part of it was they wanted me out of the house. I think the other part of it was they knew that I could do better than them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to say that we ever did badly. Like, we never needed money, but
sure.
We were not rich. Farmer, not rich. No, the cash flow is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But
flows right back out.
It does. But what's interesting is I didn't realize the financial situation of our farm until I was much older.
Sure.
And so we never went without. Like, if I think my parents bought a new car every 3 to 5 years. Well, I shouldn't say new. Used and rolled off the lot, but mostly new.
Mm-hmm.
Within the same year that you were buying it, right? I always had toys. I say we, I'm an only child for the most part. My next eldest is 20 years my senior. It's a little bit weird there, but as an only child, I didn't really go without. Like, I always, you know, had the toys. I had my Nintendo when I was, you know, was like 8. So decently new. But we never had money. Like, we were never the ones to just go on a spending spree. Like,
sure.
we always had to budget every month. It was, well, do we have money for groceries? Do we have money for bills? And I remember my parents freaking out about some of this stuff. I guess freaking out wouldn't really be a good word, but spending a lot of time and effort to make sure that the income and the outflow was appropriate.
Taken care of.
And I didn't understand that growing up, obviously. Not really into financials when you're 12. So I'm sure there's someone out there that's listening. It is good for you. I was into coding when I was 8, so go to you.
There you go. Just don't be into scotch yet.
Not yet.
No. 21.
Sorry. But yeah, so it was one of those fun things where I completely lost my train of thought because of that little segue.
That's what this podcast is all about.
It's fantastic.
Yeah,
and you're not even drinking.
I know, right? Speaking of drinking, what are we drinking? What are you drinking?
Ainslie Bray.
Ainslie Bray. This is aged in oat cask. This is our season's whiskey.
Scotch. I mean, whiskey with no E.
Sorry. Yeah.
Scotch whiskey is scotch.
It's true. Is whiskey scotch? Scotch is whiskey.
Scotch
is like
whiskey.
It's like squares and rectangles.
A square is a rectangle, for those of you who are wondering.
Squares.
So scotch is a whiskey?
Yes.
So.
See, now you've got to clarify.
Okay. The way I'm given to understand it is that whiskey is Irish whiskey. whisky is scotch whiskey, or scotch whiskey, also known as scotch. Okay. And scotch has a very... And not very different, but does have some different elements to its production that give it its flavor. One of which is being how much, I don't know which chemical it is, but there's a chemical in the peat that they use to dry the grains. Once they've picked the grains and they dry them, they put them in smokehouses and they burn peat moss I don't know if it's peat moss, it's peat. They burn the peat underneath it, almost smoking it like you would smoke meat. And so the smoke comes up through these floors, and there's pictures of guys just raking grains over these floors. And every Scotch distillery, whiskey probably, I haven't studied a whole lot of whiskey, Irish whiskey. Every Scottish whiskey distillery I've seen has almost like a steeple where the smoke comes up and out. And the more of this, leave the comment if you know, the more of this chemical is found in the peat, the smokier the flavor. You know, everyone kind of associates scotch with a really smoky, really woodsy, kind of earthy flavor. Really, that's only on scotches from Islay, which is this tiny little island off the Hebrides, off the western coast of Scotland, because there the peat that kind of grows or is there that they use to smoke the grain is extremely heavy in some of these chemicals that give it that really, you know, tire fire. Mm. I love it.
Love a good tire fire.
Love a good tire fire. Excellent. Give it that flavor. It's actually measured in parts per million. So you can judge how smoky a scotch is by how much chemical this part. And I don't know what the chemical is, Jake. Maybe you do.
Not off the top of my head. No, but I was going to say, like, the less sciencey difference between scotch and whiskey is actually mostly geographic as well.
Okay.
Like, scotch can only come from Scotland.
Like, champagne only comes from the Champagne region of France.
Yeah, and so there's tons of wines that are like that. Cognac.
Sparkling wines.
Yeah. Cognac has also got the same sorts of ideas, things like that. And so, but scotch, like, because it's regional, it is going to taste different from other types of whiskey with an E or only with a Y, no matter what, because you're still getting it from grains from that area and still doing it with procedures from that area. But I think this puts us into a pretty good place to wrap up the second episode of the podcast. Timing wise, I think we're pretty good. So final closing thoughts on this whole, I'm not going to say war between.
We just kind of barely dipped our toe in the scotch bowl, didn't we?
We did. But hey, you know what? It's the second episode of this podcast. We're trying to figure out what we're going to, how we're going to structure this later. But closing thoughts on, I'm not going to call it a war, but this kind of tension between trade schools, apprenticeships, quote unquote, dirty jobs, versus
clean jobs,
white collar, 4-year, 8-year degrees.
Right. Well, it's really cliche, and here comes the grad school cowbell buzzword. It's really cliche to say, oh, there needs to be nuance, there needs to be a balance, but there does, because you have, on the one hand, the kind of, I don't want to say zeitgeist, but almost the ethos of, you know, putting 4-year degrees and advanced higher education on a pedestal, because at one point it did lead basically to a guaranteed sustainable lifestyle. And it was kind of the glamorous thing, or kind of the, you know, the sophisticated thing to do. There's drawbacks in every stretch, you know. Ironically, I have the most schooling of anyone here, and I make the least amount of money of anyone here. I make half as much as you guys do. Exactly half as, anyway. But on the other hand, you know, these quote unquote dirty jobs, these vo-tech schools, are not a silver bullet. There's a lot that maybe doesn't get as much attention. The labor is immense. When I was a mechanic, we had a shop foreman who was the shop foreman because he wasn't able to do the big jobs anymore. He was 44 and he had had 3 of his vertebrae fused.
Jeez.
By the time he was 44, you know, and he made a decent amount of money because he'd been doing it since he was 19. But, you know, these quote unquote dirty jobs, I'll stop saying quote, can be very hard on you.
Yeah.
Both in the physical sense and in the financial sense at the beginning. They always like to say, oh, well, this welder's making $75,000 a year in Seattle. That's basically poverty wages.
Yeah. You know, in Seattle.
Seattle. And that's a big thing, is where is the cost of living located in the city where you're occupying or you're engaged in these jobs? Yeah. In Spokane, not so bad. You know, but also you're not going to make $75,000 a year.
Not right out of the gate.
$75,000 a year as a welder. Definitely not out the gate. So there's a lot that needs to go into them. I do think there needs to be more, you know, break the stigma to show that these are legitimate good career paths, but it needs to be honest. You know, we don't need to sell these jobs to kids. We need to say, hey, this is a viable option if you want it. So I think if you give young people enough information and enough and the right tools to kind of make these decisions and just be transparent with them, I think you'll start to see a lot more of these skilled labor jobs start to be filled.
Right.
Well, what's really interesting, I think, and just kind of as a closing note, young people need to do research. They need to spend time to actually find out what they want to go into, and yep. when they're going into something, they need to look, you know, and balance the potential costs of schooling with their potential earnings abilities after they get out. Also looking at the job market. One thing that I did notice when I was going to college was there was a huge boom for IT, and everybody was going into IT during that time frame. Well, guess what happened 5 years later? We don't need IT anymore. We're good. And suddenly it became nursing. Nursing was the new hot button. But now we have like half the populace who has IT degrees and has no place to go. And so they've been edged out by, you know, random people who have some experience or luck of the draw, better meshing personalities, whatever you want to call it. They got the job and they're going to stay in that career path for a while, which means that job not going to be available. And so it really does behoove you to research the area you want to go into, find out what the market looks like today, but also look at trends.
BLS.
You know, make sure that the trend is where you want it to be. Because if there is just a huge insurgence of the people coming into that market space, maybe it's not a good place to be.
Yeah.
You know, now that's to say, you know, don't pick something you're going to hate.
Yeah.
But try to find something that you can live with, because that's what you're going to have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for each person, that sort of threshold's probably going to be different. Like,
oh, absolutely.
You know, I am the kind of person, Dad, who, like, if I had gone into orthodontistry or whatever, it's not something that I was super interested in. Still am not, but I could certainly, you know, make that my living and then do something that I wanted to do outside of that. Not necessarily programming. I fell in love with programming after I started looking into it as a vocation. But I also do that now. I have other things that I do that I'm working to be fulfilling personally, if not, you know, monetarily and stuff. I think the biggest thing that I always struggle with and am so sad when I hear about is like this assignment of worth, either coming from either direction
yeah.
for what you're doing is like, you know, the traditional argument that people rail against is like, oh, just because you have a 4-year degree doesn't mean that, you know, you're worth anything more. And that's true. But also like we have like one is not worth more than the other. You don't have to both, or you don't have to be right and the other person has to be right. wrong in this particular argument. And if that's the one thing that
Are
I could send
it's
home,
not black and white and there's nuance here.
I know. I need that cowbell for the grad school.
The nuance swear jar.
The nuance swear jar. But if that's like the one thing that I could ever drive home with anybody, especially like when I was talking with my former students, it was just like, know that your worth is outside of your vocation.
Yeah.
Outside of what other people think of you, but like what your level of education is. I'm always going to push for more education because I think it's super important. But that doesn't mean that you're less worth something. And that doesn't mean that your field is worth less than another one because you only spent 2 years in a school or in an apprenticeship versus something else. And if you went into a 4-year degree, don't mean that your degree is worth anything, that you are as a person are worth anything more or anything less than people going into these trades.
Yeah. And so that's interesting. I don't mean to stretch this out more. when I was selling cars over in Seattle, one of my first clients came in late in the day and I was joking around about lawyers. Turned out she was a lawyer. Had my dad as a teacher. Anyway, beside the point, she was a lawyer, public defender or a public attorney, and her husband was a longshoreman in the Port of Tacoma. And for about half a second, I was like,
How does that happen?
Because that's just me not being woke or whatever.
Sure.
Because you don't associate very, very quote unquote white collar jobs with matching up with more kind of, you know, the blue collar type yeah. work. So even, you know, woke AF Griff still falls victim to there's a cowbell. He still falls victim to that, you know, kind of box of thinking.
Yeah. It's tough. And it's something that like as we learn to break as a society, I think it's going to put better worth out into the market because we're going to start seeing these types of jobs get filled yeah. again in all sectors. Yeah. So that was my little soapbox.
Perfect.
Anyways.
So thank you all for tuning in to Scotch and Socialism. Remember to drink and listen responsibly and have a good evening.
Bye.
quick editor's note at the end of our podcast, we would love to hear from any and all of our listeners. If you'd like to send us an email to scotchandsocialism@gmail.com or leave a comment on our website, scotchandsocialism.com. Thanks again, and remember to listen and drink responsibly.